This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Chicago Coliseum, July 9th, 1896. Moses ascended the mountaintop. Mount Sinai was the podium rising above the Sea of Delegates. Two stone tablets decreed that the U.S. government's monetary supply be backed with reserves of silver instead of gold, along with a zealous commitment to heal the wounds that America's 1% had inflicted on everyone else. Greedy idolaters had worshipped capitalism's golden calf for far too long. That's why God, in his infinite mercy and wisdom, had finally sent America a prophet. 36 years old, his name, William Jennings Bryan. The seething mass of humanity inside Chicago's enormous brand new Coliseum looked up to Bryan, the Democratic Party's nomination for President of the United States, whose imposing height, massive head, and piercing brown eyes made him a striking figure. As Bryan held forth the Democratic's proposed national platform, they shouted and cheered, frantically waving red bandanas in a sign of solidarity with the global workers' movement that had been sweeping Europe for decades. For the first time at this convention, the delegates saw a man of presidential timber on the stage above them. And for the first time in generations, they actually saw a savior. The sweltering Chicago heat and the stench of thousands of sweating bodies inside the convention hall threatened to overcome him, but Bryan steadied himself for this moment atop Sinai. His knuckles turned white as he grabbed the sides of the lectern. He had never lacked for confidence. So now that thousands of eyes among the party faithful were upon him, now that reporters were furiously scribbling his every word in their notebooks, now that the moment he had been waiting for his whole life was upon him, William Jennings Bryan knew he would not falter. Bryan had arrived in Chicago uncertain of his chances of becoming his party's presidential nominee, but as his speech progressed, he became convinced that victory was his. A new monetary policy based on the coinage of silver, free silver, had proven to be an even more enticing message than he'd expected. The new supply of money would relieve crippling debts for the farmers and other impoverished voters Bryan sought to mobilize. As he neared the climax of his remarks, he mustered every last ounce of energy he could and unleashed some of the most famous lines in American political rhetoric. "If they dare come out in the open field," he thundered, "and defend the gold standard as a good thing, we shall fight them to the uttermost, having behind us the producing masses of the nation and the world, and having behind us the commercial interests and the laboring interest and the toiling masses." Bryan paused, raised his hands above his head, and continued, "We shall answer their demands for a gold standard by saying to them, you shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns." He brought his hands down around his head as if he were placing an imaginary crown on top. Then he stretched out his arms to the sides, palms towards the delegates, and took a deep breath and bellowed, "You shall not crucify mankind upon the cross of gold." Moses had now morphed into Jesus, and the multitude assembled thought that they were witnessing the second coming. Their shouts thundered through the Colosseum, shaking its steel girders and echoing down city blocks in every direction. "Bedlam broke loose," exclaimed a stunned Washington Post correspondent. "Delirium reigned supreme." In the spoken word of the orator, thousands of great men had heard the unexpressed sentiments and hopes of their own innermost souls, end quote. With that speech in 1896, the era of progressivism and the progressives, featuring the biggest liars in American history, had begun. Many experts have written about progressivism, and I've talked about it on the air for more than a decade now, so I'm guessing that you're already a little bit familiar with its frightening and demonstrable outcomes. The insatiable thirst for control and the betterment of others, the determination to build a massive, all-controlling welfare state that holds the rest of us hostage to its preferences and its whims, and the flirtation with totalitarianism masked by the guise of political correctness. Progressives regularly espouse ideas and support causes that openly involve the loss of free will, murder, or mutilation of their fellow human beings, always in the name of a better world for all. When their policies are actually implemented, they unfailingly achieve the opposite of their promised results. And yet, despite this, no amount of empirical data seems to dissuade progressives and their acolytes from embracing their flawed policies the next time around, even when they can easily be shown to be disastrous. Given these failures time and time again, it's only right to wonder, how is it that progressive leaders and voters continue to cling to policies and programs that just simply never work? Are progressive leaders such masters of lying and deception that their followers can easily be fooled, even in the face of undeniable evidence? Or is it rather that the followers of progressivism are so eager to be lied to that they willfully ignore the facts and reason? We search for this answer and find it in the book Liars. And the answer is really both. Our answers, among all creatures that have ever existed, are endowed by their creator with something unique in the animal kingdom, something that sets us apart from every other living organism. As we discussed this difference, as it was encapsulated by the anthropologist Ernest Becker in his book The Denial of Death, Justin Wheeler explains.
Primary premise here is that human beings are the only creature that is both aware of and conscious of our own permanent demise, that death is going to reach all of us. It's unavoidable. So we have this dichotomy in man. We want to live. We have the same instincts of other animals. We want to live and progress, but ultimately we are going to fail in that mission. We know, as other creatures do not, that we're going to die.
That fear of death helps us to survive as individuals and ultimately as a species.
And that's what makes progressivism so powerful in people's lives is, you know, you have this fear dynamic. So there is this unconscious, never-ending fear that something is going to get us. And we inherited that through evolutionary biology. We share it with all mammals. If you look at a herd of deer out in the field, they are constantly on the lookout for something that's going to come get them. They flip their tails, they eat a little bit, and they look up and they look around. Unconsciously, human beings do that all the time. We are in a constant state of fear.
But what keeps us going forward or progressing?
Other psychologists have gone further than Becker and actually refer to it as terror management theory.
Interesting.
The Worm at the Core is a book that talks about that. And it literally is that we unconsciously were in this constant state of fear. And so what the human brain had to develop over time to counteract that was what we refer to as the quintessential human emotion. And that is hope. Hope is the counteragent to the fear that it's constantly there eating away at us. And hope is what gives us the strength to go on, even though consciously we are aware that any given day we are going to die.
Hope is what enables inherently irrational action against all impossible odds, fighting each battle, while knowing that the war will eventually be lost. Dr. Jerome Groopman, a Harvard Medical School professor who has spent years studying the science of hope, discovered that the brain releases chemicals that cause a hopeful sensation after a traumatizing experience. Hope helps us overcome hurdles that we otherwise couldn't scale. He wrote, "And it moves us forward to a place where healing can occur," end quote. These chemicals create an effect almost identical to that of morphine, a calming, peaceful sensation. Hope and change, anyone? Fear and hope, the two things that make humans unique, the two things that the progressive movement has tapped into for centuries now. Wheeler gives a modern example of how big government progressives play off this fear by enlisting hope, fear and hope, feelings that are not always rational.
So take something like the war on poverty. No matter what facts and figures you present in front of them, say, look, the war on poverty has created more impoverished people. No matter how much money you spend on it, all it does is make people addicted to the program itself. It doesn't actually solve the problem. What they want is something that makes them feel good, not right. Something that actually does good. Yeah. And that's the significant difference between, I think what you're talking about, this illogical thing, Ayn Rand referred to this in Atlas Shrugged as the blank out. Like, somehow, liberals are able to shut off the rational part of their mind and not incorporate it into their decision-making. And Becker's premise was basically that the fear of all these things, the thing that might destroy us, the thing that might kill us, the thing that prevents us from living on forever and having a heroic image, the fear of that is so great that we are capable of shutting off our rational mind.
Author Bob Hamp, who wrote the book Think Differently, Live Differently, discusses the importance of emotional health in the realm of the two ideas that have been competing in America since its inception.
One of the core issues of emotional health is independence, freedom and responsibility. And in family theory, you know, family psychology, the idea is that people are everyone's supposed to move from dependence to independence. The process of individuation is central to emotional maturity and emotional health. And so at every family, in every family system, you've got two problems on the table at any given time. One of them is, what are we dealing with now? Is there a family crisis? Is there a circumstance? Are we trying to move from one house to another? And in the midst of that, are we creating dependence in our family? Are we creating independence in our family? Emotional health is based around independence, or an internal locus of control.
Independence, dependence, and control. The root of the conflict between a free people and progressives who claim they know better for mankind. In the next episode, a look at the thinkers from the last several hundred years who set the stage for where we are today.
Glenn Beck, The Blaze Radio Network.
Everything has a beginning, including the philosophy of progressivism. And though progressive thoughts and ideas run rampant in our politics and culture today in the 21st century, progressivism isn't a new idea. In fact, the roots go back much further than even our founding. In my new book, Liars, we trace this history back long before Obama or Clinton came to the scene, long before Lyndon Johnson covered America in his idea of the Great Society. Progressive thought preceded Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, and its roots were planted even before Woodrow Wilson or Teddy Roosevelt came onto the scene of American politics. No, the genesis of progressive ideology can be traced back to the continent of Europe hundreds of years ago, even before Karl Marx himself. To find the roots of progressivism, one has to go back to Germany, the Germany of the 1500s, and the Protestant Reformation against the Catholic Church brought on by Martin Luther. Was Martin Luther a progressive? No, hardly. But his ideas about man's relationship with God has morphed and metastasized over the past 500 years into something completely unrecognizable from what Luther originally thought. Justin Wheeler explains.
A lot of the ideas around progressivism are rooted in the German Enlightenment era. And it's really interesting to kind of look at how that manifested. Certainly if you had had the opportunity to be back and talk to Martin Luther or talk to Nietzsche, they would not have referred to themselves as progressive. This is a modern appellation we have piled on top of their form of thought. Certainly most of these men were deeply religious in one form or another. Many modern progressives are not in a specific way. But in terms of understanding the philosophy, sort of how the thinking around who human beings were, what their relationship was to God, what their relationship was to each other, really looking at the German Enlightenment period is quite an interesting place to kind of start.
So how did Martin Luther's declaration that man could have a personal relationship with God instead of enlisting an official that could go between start the ball rolling down the hill towards progressivism that we know today?
What ended up being the philosophical roots that laid the groundwork so that progressivism as we know it today, or as we might understand it today, could take hold and, start to become the primary mode of human beings to intercourse with each other, form governments, and things like that. So I think starting with Martin Luther and the Reformation movement is kind of an interesting place to start, because you can see a clear change in man and his relationship to God, as opposed to man's relationship to God being through a papal leader. Man's relationship to God could become personal, and that started with Martin Luther and the Reformation.
Our roundtable continued.
But without the Protestant Reformation, there wasn't enough opportunity for people to even propose philosophies that were around the idea of man can have a personal relationship to God, or God doesn't have to be the Almighty God up in heaven sitting on a throne that's from the Bible. God can be society.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, what God manifested into.
Because I do think of the Reformation as a time when freedom and responsibility, you know, when you distribute that into the hands of the common people and out of the hands of the hierarchy of the church.
Absolutely.
In those days, that really is the opportunity for freedom and responsibility. In the same way, it's the opportunity for all manner of what goes wrong with human beings.
While Martin Luther took the religious path in Germany, making it known that mankind could have a personal relationship with God, it was no more than two centuries later in the late 1700s when another German, a university professor named George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, would use his disbelief in God to better humanity. Friedrich's views on God were shaped at a very young age, and he never looked back on this disbelief.
Hegel, in his childhood, had a terribly traumatic experience where his epidemic had come through his part of Germany. It was really just influenza, but his entire family was afflicted. He was a very young boy. He was feverish. He woke up in bed. He yelled out for his mother. She didn't respond. He yelled out again. She didn't respond. He started wandering through the house looking for her, you know, dizzy, holding himself up against the wall. He wanders into her room and finds her dead in her bed with her, the father laying next to her. He thinks he's also dead.
He touched his father's cheek, expecting the same coldness from the grayish skin. But as he touched him, his father stirred with a slight moan. George William Friedrich Hegel's father was still alive. And so was he. 13 years old, he sank his head into the blanket, relief overwhelming him. He and his father had both survived the fever, but barely. His relief soon gave way to anger, however. Why? Why had God abandoned them? The priest had put a blessing on their house. George prayed every single day, pleading with God to spare his family. But God hadn't listened. Or maybe had listened, but couldn't do anything about it. Either way, it didn't matter. George decided then and there that no other family should ever have to go through that. If God couldn't help, then he would. While America's experiment with personal freedom was hitting its stride by implementing God's law, Europe was dealing with its own revolutionary wave. French Emperor Napoleon Bonaparte was marching through Europe when a man who would become known as the father of progressivism, Professor Hegel, took notice of Bonaparte, the conqueror. Hegel believed that the history of mankind was the story of man becoming more and more rational and achieving consciousness to perfect humanity. All that was needed was a government that tamed the impulses of human nature for the greater good. This was Hegel's revolutionary idea of progress. Like many progressives who followed in his wake, Hegel also dabbled in race theory to explain why some societies seemed to progress better or faster than others. The German nations, he wrote, were the first to achieve consciousness. 22 inferior genes, he believed, were the only way to explain why other parts of the world remained economically backward. Hegel concluded that the world now stood at one of the most advanced stages of human history, and that experts and knowledgeable persons should rule with the most perfect government and unlimited authority over the individual. Through the state and its rulers, in Hegel's philosophy of history, man essentially became God on earth. This was the foundational principle of what eventually became known as progressivism. Another name from the Enlightenment period is Immanuel Kant, another philosopher from Germany.
Immanuel Kant, one of his primary philosophies, especially as it ended up being applied to politics, although he himself said he was never certain that this should be applied to politics because he didn't know if it was possible. But it was the idea of the perfectibility of man, in particular when applied to politics, the idea of perpetual or permanent peace. That it could and potentially should be something that would be achieved.
Wheeler continued.
He even said, now I'm not sure that this is possible because I'm not sure man is perfectible, but he should be. If he's not, we're missing something. And, next evolution of that was Nietzsche. Nietzsche found the thing that was preventing us from moving to that next level and finding the perfectibility of man, and that was God.
Friedrich Nietzsche, the man who coined the phrase, God is dead, also from Germany. But when achieving perfection on earth proves to be impossible, that heaven is only in the afterlife, and the people themselves are considered to be the obstacle, the next step is to implement one's vision of utopia by force.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck. The Blaze Radio Network.
The founder of Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger.
The first step would thus be to control the intake and output of morons, mental defectives, and epileptics. The second step would be to take an inventory of the secondary groups such as illiterates, paupers, unemployables, criminals, prostitutes, dope ends. Classify them in special departments under government, medical, protection, and segregate.
Margaret Sanger believed in a policy of race improvement, once saying that it was necessary to, quote, create a race of thoroughbreds, end quote. This is known as the thoroughbred theory, which Donald Trump and his family ascribed to. In 1926, she even saw fit to present her views before a women's chapter of the Ku Klux Klan, which led to a dozen invitations to speak to similar groups. How does an American woman arrive at this kind of thinking? November 1892. Margaret was just a little girl. There was a tragic accident at her home while her father was away one night. On a cold winter night, two vagrants rapped on the door of the house where Margaret Sanger resided with her family. The two men stamped their feet to keep warm, and as the door opened, the warmth of a coal fire stove poured out over them. At first, the matronly woman in her early 40s stepped back to allow the visitors inside. But after scrutinizing the men, she had second thoughts and quickly moved to block their entry. There's an instant of silence, cut only by the splash of sleet on the stepping stones outside. Behind the woman, the curious eyes of several children on the steps probe silently.
"Is the boss in?"
one of the men asks.
"No, but I'm looking for him any minute."
"We want something to eat."
Not wavering in her command of the threshold, the woman stood for a moment longer, considering but silent. She's accustomed to these types of visitors, tramps and vagabonds, the knights of the open road who traveled between New York City and the odd jobs in the country. Over the years, hundreds of men and dozens of children have found sanctuary in their house with free access to food, milk, warm beds, as well as glasses of whiskey, always favored by their host. Margaret's mother, Anne, has always borne it patiently, quietly, in the wisdom that, despite having 11 children of their own, the Christian upbringing of her husband, which has evolved into open adoption of socialism in the waves of reform sweeping the eastern seaboard, simply wouldn't allow him to turn away the needy. They are living, breathing adherents of the social gospel. Jesus, they believe, has commanded them to share their property, and that includes their home on a cold night like this. Were her husband there and not out of town on business, Anne knows he would admonish her for having second thoughts about inviting them in with a smile. But every instinct in her tells her to turn these men away. Sensing the hesitation and without further ceremony, the men push by Anne into the house, heading towards the kitchen. On the stairs, one of the family dogs starts to bark, and Margaret, the eldest of the children, strains to hold the hound back from its protective instinct. Leaving the door open, Anne bristles and moves defensively toward the foot of the stairs, declaring crossly, "How dare you come into this house?" Ignoring her, the men begin searching for food. One throws open his cupboards, while the other stuffs rolls into his pockets of his trench coat. On a small desk near the stairs, Anne notices her husband's tools, a hammer and chisel. She looks up at little Margaret on the steps, takes a deep breath, and turns back to the men.
"Toss, Beauty,"
she shouts, beckoning the two dogs to come to her side. Hearing the fear in her voice, the dogs bark and snarl, leaping down the steps, lunging past the children, and onto the backs of the men ransacking the cupboards. Anne turns towards the stairs with a stern, desperate message. "Margaret, keep the children there, no matter what happens." The children watch their mother charge forward to chase the men away. The dogs snarl and bite. The men throw punches and food and utensils to fend them off.
and swings the hammer at one of them, landing a blow on his cheek, only to have him smash her across the face with the back of his clenched fist. She falls hard to the floor, just as the other man lands a kick in her side. The children cry out from the stairs, "No, mother!" while one of the dogs is felled with a blow from the hammer that Anne dropped. The other retreated into the corner and barks and growls as the men grab what food they can and scamper out the door. For an instant, after they leave, it's impossibly silent. Snow and sleet splash in through the open door and onto the floor, mixing with splatters of blood and milk that spilled during the fracas. On the stairs, the children sob quietly. Following orders, Margaret comforts them, but doesn't allow any to venture down, even to see if their mother is still alive. Time passes. The lone candle burns down and dies out. As he approaches the home, Michael, Margaret's father, notices there are no lights in the windows. He sees the front door hanging open and immediately senses something is very wrong. He runs and lunges through the door, slipping to the floor in his haste. On his knees, he crawls to his wife, who's lying now in a pool of blood. Her breathing is raspy. Her body is cold to the touch. But she is alive. "Margaret!" he yells towards the stairs. His daughter leaves her post at the top of the landing and crouches next to him. She fetches a wet cloth from the sink, and they begin to clean Anne's wounds. Michael shakes his wife lightly, trying to wake her. "Get whiskey," he instructs his daughter. She obeys and brings the bottle from a drawer in his desk. Margaret Sanger's mother would never quite be the same after this attack, and being sickly from then on, she would die just a few short years later. Traumatic events like this are, of course, no excuse for advocating the elimination of entire races, but it does, perhaps, give us some insight into how the deranged thinking of Margaret Sanger began. Sanger also believed that families with too many children, remember she was one of 11 kids, posed an unnecessary hardship on the rest of society. Quote, "The most merciful thing that the large family does to one of its members," she wrote in 1920, "is to kill it." End quote. It's worth noting that Planned Parenthood claims that this quote is out of context, that it's really about the rising infant death rate among large families at the time. But let's assume they're right. Does that make this statement okay? That it's merciful to have a child and then kill it just because there is some percentage of chance that it might die anyway? Sanger is perhaps best known as the early staunch advocate of birth control, including abortion, and as the founder of the organization that would eventually grow into Planned Parenthood. Its original name was a bit more honest, the American Birth Control League. But the reasoning behind her zeal was deeper and darker than simply a disregard for individual human lives. Sanger believed that contraception, especially preventing birth among certain undesirables, was better for the human race as a whole. In 1922, she wrote,
"Those least fit to carry on the race are increasing most rapidly. People who cannot support their own offspring are encouraged by church and state to produce large families. Many of the children thus begotten are diseased or feeble-minded. Many become criminals. Funds that should be used to raise the standard of our civilization are diverted to the maintenance of those who should never have been born."
Despite these radical views, Sanger is, to this day, a progressive icon and hero. In 2009, Hillary Clinton proudly accepted the Margaret Sanger Award from Planned Parenthood.
"It was a great privilege when I was told that I would receive this award. I admire Margaret Sanger enormously, her courage, her tenacity, her vision."
For a singular moment, Hillary Clinton told the truth. She admires, as she said in her own words, this racist, bigoted, self-appointed deity who saw fit to decide who should get the gift of life and who should have it taken away.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Glenn Beck. The Blaze Radio Network.
In 1912, there were at least two massive disasters for the United States of America. The sinking of the Titanic and the election of progressive Woodrow Wilson. Just a month after the completion of the grim Titanic recovery operation, Woodrow Wilson addressed the prestigious Economic Club of New York at a hotel bearing the name of one of the Titanic's most prominent victims. Speaking to business leaders at the Times Square's Hotel Astor, Wilson pushed back against the complaints that his ideas opposed the free enterprise system. He believed that wealthy families such as the Astors had turned the American Republic into their own fiefdom. The rich, he said, had to be reined in and their wealth confiscated for the public good if necessary.
The very thing the government cannot let alone is business,
Wilson blustered.
Government cannot take its hands off business. Government must regulate business because that is the foundation of every other relationship.
The tragic sinking of the Titanic, a ship that its owners boasted was unsinkable, was the consequence of a hubristic humanist assumption about man's ability to control natural law and to defy the will of God. And so was the candidacy of Woodrow Wilson. If you've ever listened to me on radio or TV, you probably know I hate that guy, and I'm not a member of good standing in the Woodrow Wilson fan club. But what you might not know, however, is that neither is the American public. Not a single recent public opinion survey lists Wilson as among the greatest U.S. presidents. Even Jimmy Carter is more popular. Yes, Jimmy Carter. But unfortunately, the people who write history haven't quite figured out just how awful a president, not to mention a person, Woodrow Wilson actually was. In fact, few former presidents are held in such high esteem by modern liberals and progressives. Historians, most of them progressives themselves, routinely rank Wilson among the top 10 of the nation's chief executives. In fact, two polls conducted by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. rated Wilson behind only Lincoln, Washington, and big surprise, Franklin Roosevelt. Now, how can that be explained? Here's Howard University's historian Edna Medford's attempt. How we rank our presidents is, to a large extent, influenced by our own times. Today's concerns shape our views of the past, be it the area of foreign policy, managing the economy, or human rights, end quote. Well, if that's true, it only makes the liberal academic fetish for Wilson even more bizarre. Few presidents displayed such an open contempt for the Constitution they swore to preserve, protect, and defend. Even fewer had such severe disdain for women, minorities, and anyone else who deviated from Wilson's view of the, quote, perfect citizen, end quote. Yet some modern progressives have mixed emotions about Wilson. Listen to this actual recording of President Wilson telling Native Americans how good they have had it in America.
There are some dark pages in the history of the white man's dealings with the Indians. And many parts of the record are stained with the greed and avarice of those who have thought only of their own profit. But it is also true that the purposes and motives of this great government and of our nation as a whole toward the red men have been wise, just, and beneficent. The remarkable progress of our Indian brothers toward civilization is proof of it and open to all to see. During the past half century, you have seen the schoolhouse take the place of the military post on your reservations. The administration of Indian affairs has been transferred from the military to the civil arm of the government. The education and industrial training the government has given you has enabled thousands of Indian men and women to take their places in civilization alongside their white neighbors. Thousands are living in substantial farmhouses on their own separate allotments of land. Hundreds of others have won places of prominence in the profession, and some have worked their way into the halls of Congress and into places of responsibility in our state and national governments. 30,000 Indian children are enrolled in government, state, and mission schools. The great white father now calls you his brothers, not his children. Because you have shown in your education and in your settled ways of life staunch, manly, worthy qualities of sound character.
Embarrassed by his blatant prejudices, a few have demanded that his name be stripped from Princeton's elite Woodrow Wilson School of Government, as Chasing News points out.
Rohan, you chased the story to Princeton University, where a bunch of kids are protesting a sit-in at the president's office, upset about the fact that Woodrow Wilson is the name of one of the colleges within the university. What do you got?
Yeah, absolutely, guys. Wednesday at Princeton University, members and supporters of student group Black Justice League walked out of class to protest racism that they believe is at their school. They showed up to the office of the university president at Nassau Hall to demand that the name of Woodrow Wilson be stripped off every building, program title, and a mural in the dining hall be removed.
All right, well, I found a big one. Big sign that says Wilson College. The Wilcox Dining Hall is right inside. And I peeked through the windows. And guess what I found? Nice, big Woodrow Wilson mural.
But the battle doesn't stop at Princeton. There are many other schools fighting the same battle across the country, as the D.C. reports.
The growing movement to find new appellations for buildings, landmarks, and even bodies of water named after Confederate leaders has finally expanded to reach Woodrow Wilson, America's 28th president. A history teacher at Woodrow Wilson High School in Portland, Oregon, is lobbying for the school to change its name. The teacher, Hyung Nam, has been calling for a new name for Wilson High for several months. The history teacher wrote in an April 22nd email to all staffers, "We'd have to be ignorant about history to continue to affiliate ourselves with this man."
Yet most still seem to excuse him, in much the same way they excuse the abhorrent behavior of people like Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, or Robert Byrd, simply because these people represent an ideology that they support. Never is this more apparent than in the case of Woodrow Wilson. Here, for example, is an all-too-typical description of him from the nonpartisan University of Virginia's Miller Center.
Woodrow Wilson was one of America's greatest presidents. His domestic program expanded the role of the federal government in managing the economy and protecting the interests of citizens. His foreign policy established a new vision of America's role in the world, and he helped to make the White House the center of power in Washington. Most historians rank him among the five most important American presidents, along with Washington, Lincoln, and the Roosevelts.
Note how the Miller Center folks call him one of the greatest, not the most consequential, which might actually be accurate. And also note that they directly tie his greatness to expanding the role of the federal government and the creation of an imperial presidency. But it's not just academics like those at the Miller Center who display a fawning love for Wilson. In 2002, an episode of the PBS series American Experience glowingly, quote, explores the transformation of a history professor into one of America's greatest presidents, end quote. Radical liberal Prime Minister David Lloyd George, who in many ways was Britain's version of Wilson, once even likened Woodrow Wilson to Jesus Christ. In the 1960s, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, another Wilson acolyte, spearheaded the formation of D.C.'s Woodrow Wilson Center. In announcing the project, Johnson proclaimed that there could be no more fitting monument to the memory of Wilson than an institution devoted to the highest ideals of scholarship and international understanding, end quote. In November 2015, The Washington Post columnist Richard Cohen even penned an article titled, "Woodrow Wilson Was a Racist, But He Deserves Our Understanding," end quote. So why does Woodrow Wilson deserve our understanding when others do not? Is it because he was a transformational progressive who supported liberal causes such as the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Trade Commission, the implementation of the federal income tax, and the creation of a global world government, the League of Nations? Oh, make no mistake, you can bet it is. Wilson's presidency was the beginning of the end for the radical experiment of individual liberty that the founders had fought for. So how did it happen? Well, much like the case of the Titanic, the story of how something goes from mighty, brave, and unsinkable to slowly breaking apart and becoming a footnote in history requires the same relentless forces of humanity that the founders tried so hard to protect its citizens from: hubris, greed, and most of all, fear.
Want more serials? You can listen to every episode at glennbeck.com/serials. Next week, you'll learn about the progressive liars in the failed temperance movement, prohibition, and the man who redefined the term progressive forever, FDR.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Wayne Wheeler swung his newly sharpened scythe through the alfalfa grass that came up to his hips. At 5'6" with a tidy mustache, he didn't very much look the part of an Ohio farmer. His father, Joseph, had insisted that his son become an educated man, to go to college and become a lawyer or a doctor. Young Wayne had every intention on following through with his dad's wish. He loved his books, but he also loved the rough and tumble of farm life. Every July, his father would summon him, his siblings, and a handful of farmhands from neighboring towns to the fields, where they would work days on end from sunup to sunset, cutting the season's supply of hay. Wayne liked the feel of the calluses on his hand at the end of the harvest season. He liked being around the farmhands who joked and cursed. Even now, as beads of sweat gathered on his upper lip in the sweltering Ohio sun, he found the musty, comforting smell of freshly cut grass wafting towards the nostrils intoxicating. But with each passing summer, Wayne noticed something troubling about a number of the farmhands. A few tormented souls who staggered in each morning, eyes bloodshot and smelling of alcohol. They'd sneak sips of their favorite liquid from mason jars, kept out of sight by his devout Congregationalist father. One time, Wayne had been upstairs in his house when a drunken farmhand ran in from the fields in a maniacal rage, muttering in long, slurred sentences,
"But I ain't gonna do a hideous thing like that until I have my way with you two beauties."
His mother and sister were now screaming for help. "Joseph!" they cried out. "Joseph!" Wayne cowered under his bed, covering his ears with the palms of his hands, paralyzed by fear. He heard the front door slam open, and then the sounds of fists pummeling flesh and bone, thumps and cracks audible through the floorboards. He never saw or heard from that farmhand again, nor was the subject ever spoken about in the Wheeler household. As a boy, Wheeler saw one of his friendly and harmless town residents, a man they called Old Soak, reduced to humiliating drunkenness and have to be helped home by his father. And one day, as Wayne was busy baling hay, a drunken farmhand named Hank approached and began tossing hay everywhere. In his drunken stupor, the pitchfork the farmhand was using wound up jammed deeply into Wayne's leg. It was experiences like these that made Wayne Wheeler conclude that he would never touch alcohol. By 1893, Reverend Howard Hyde Russell was one of the nation's leading crusaders against alcohol. He had founded the Anti-Saloon League, preaching against the perils of the demon drink while a student at Oberlin College. Now, on a return visit to campus, he delivered a lecture on temperance that enthralled many of his listeners, but none more so than the student in his early 20s who found the abolition of alcohol to be a mission from God. Wayne Wheeler, who had followed his father's wishes and entered college at Oberlin, sought out Russell after his speech. The Reverend was so impressed by Wheeler's passion and zeal that he offered the young man a job on the spot. He believed he had found a worthy apprentice. He was right. In fact, he found someone who would take the Anti-Saloon League to the heights that few had imagined. Wheeler got right to work. As one of only a handful of permanent employees at the Anti-Saloon League, He rode his bike around Cleveland, evangelizing the masses during visits to churches and temperance meetings. He later enrolled in law school, knowing full well that his legal training could only help the cause. Haunted by the memories of a childhood torment, Wheeler believed that only full-scale abolition of alcohol across America would bring safety and comfort. Men could not be counted on to restrain themselves from their vices. The perfect world required absolute control over the individual. Besides, he wasn't going to let any other children cower in fear under their beds, loathing their own helplessness, while the devil's water turned men into demonic savages. However, turning the tide of public opinion against the powerful liquor industry was not going to be easy, and it wasn't going to be pretty. But it had to be done, regardless of the cost. Knowing this, Wheeler put together a Temperist army that didn't care about party or ideological labels. The Dries would support any candidate from either party who adopted temperance as his campaign platform. They would use leaflets, advertising, letter-writing campaigns, and visits from temperance advocates to increase public pressure on wavering legislators. Wheeler even coined the term pressure group to explain the league's tactics. This pressure was justified, of course, because Wheeler knew what was best for the communities. The freedom to decide whether to drink alcohol responsibly didn't belong to an individual, because those decisions affected the collective. Only sobriety could cure men who tormented their communities, people like Old Soak and Hank. Wayne Wheeler became perhaps the most powerful force in the nation regarding alcohol, as discussed in this National History Day documentary.
The Anti-Saloon League was the leading group of the Prohibition movement. In 1909, it even opened up the American Issue Publishing Company and spread its ideas and values more and more. Wayne Wheeler, while not the group's official president, led the group through the movement. Wheeler was merciless in his crusade for Prohibition. By 1903, the Anti-Saloon League had, with his help, forced all 70 of their political targets out of office, and at one point, driven Ohio Governor Myron T. Herrick out for wanting to modify one of the Anti-Saloon League's bills.
In 1915, he left behind his dry comrades in Ohio and went to Washington, D.C. to become the general counsel for the entire Anti-Saloon League of America. He scaled his pressure group tactics into a nationwide level and became one of the most effective lobbyists of his time. The Prohibition movement was quickly gaining momentum. Ken Burns, from his documentary Prohibition.
It was clear that millions of Americans had now come to support Prohibition for all sorts of reasons. Democrats as well as Republicans. Progressives as well as conservatives. Free thinkers as well as churchgoers. Some of the richest industrialists in the country, including Andrew Carnegie and Henry Ford, backed Prohibition because they believed alcohol undercut the output of their workers. The radical industrial workers of the world were for it too, because they thought alcohol was part of a capitalist plot to weaken the working man.
In 1920, thanks in large part to Wheeler's efforts, the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which banned the manufacture, sale, and transportation of intoxicating liquors in the United States, went into effect. Prohibition was now in force across the nation. But instead of creating a new perfect world, the law opened the door for bootleggers and organized crime to make millions of dollars from the distribution of liquor illegally.
So you have millions of lawbreakers, perfectly law-abiding citizens otherwise, who now are breaking a federal law by drinking. And so the line becomes blurred, and organized crime is much more intertwined in American life because of Prohibition in a way that it had not before then.
That was of little concern to Wheeler. The drunks and brutes that scared him when he was young would not be able to scare anyone else. But the lengths to which this man would go, and to get the United States to agree, are truly sickening.
So Wayne Wheeler came up with this idea and met with cabinet members from the government and met with bureaucrats from the various organizations, mostly the Treasury Department.
Progressives.
And he had the bright idea that what they should do is start putting poison into whiskey and then releasing it into the public. And that would give the government both a mechanism to catch people who were drinking, because they would show up at hospitals very, very sick. But if they died, well, they're not supposed to be drinking anyway. Actually, Wayne Wheeler referred to drinking as treasonous because the prohibition was actually passed as a constitutional amendment. Therefore, you were opposed to the Constitution if you were still drinking. So he referred to it as treason. So the government went along with this. The government actually went along with this plan that came from a lobbyist, and they started putting various forms of poison, wood alcohol and things of that nature, into whiskey, and then releasing it out into the public as a means to both catch people who were continuing to drink and potentially poison and kill people who, you know, as a form of punishment.
Up to 50,000 Americans paid the ultimate progressive price. They were essentially murdered by Wayne Wheeler and their government. But such is the price of progressivism.
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Well, that and progressivism. The nation had scarcely regained its footing from the constitutional crisis created by FDR's hero, Woodrow Wilson, a man who, among other things, oversaw the internment of over 170,000 American citizens without probable cause, due process, or any sort of trial. In subsequent years, FDR would be following Wilson's blueprint. For now, as he took the oath of office, he considered the future and the past. The man in the morning coat and top hat sat rigid, his veins coursing with adrenaline. But his head had never been more clear. He, and more important, his nation, had been waiting for this moment for decades. The reins of the federal government had become dust-covered, untouched for too long. They had to be grabbed and the slack run out on behalf of the people. And if a whip had to be taken to the concentrated powers and the princes of property to give the forgotten man his fair shake, so be it. A wry smile crossed his lips. No longer would the weak use federal power for piddling projects in the face of crisis while labor lay dormant. No longer would the strong businessmen of the great trusts and their lapdog money changers be left to shape society to their selfish whims. The ship of state was his now for the steering toward a more social, equitable, and fair system. Planning was to be the operative word of the day. Rather than wasteful, oligarchic, haphazard individualism, could the politicians who surrounded him continue just to stand there, dazed and daunted, in the face of the rot of laissez-faire lunacy? No. The invisible hand was to be brought into the night of day. There was nothing to fear but fear itself, and he knew there was no one better equipped to fill the vacuum of incompetency and inaction than himself, the newly elected President of the United States. Franklin Delano Roosevelt put his enamel cigarette holder to his lips, struck a match, and took a long drag. Thick smoke twirling in the cool air, like so many of the dreams he was about to fulfill. In that moment, he thought back to his days as a student at Groton and the much richer boys who never respected him. He thought of the last laugh he was sure to get over the bankers, the lawyers, the industrialists who had doubted his cunning and intellect at Harvard and then at Columbia Law. They thought they were powerful. Well, they will just have to watch. He thought of his late cousin Teddy and how it was time to finally make good on the bold, progressive vision and vigorous executive power that he had championed. He thought about how Teddy had commanded the bully pulpit and breathed life into the American people. He thought about how through sheer personality and grit, he too could marshal the resources of the nation for more social ends, not to mention his own. He thought of Woodrow Wilson, who had appointed him as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, just as President William McKinley had done decades earlier for Teddy. He knew he could take Wilson's revolutionary but academic critique of America and mold it into something practical and concrete. He knew that he had not merely been pandering months earlier at the 1932 Democratic Convention when he said,
"Let us feel that in everything we do, there still lives with us, if not the body, the great, indomitable, unquenchable, progressive soul of our Commander-in-Chief, Woodrow Wilson."
He thought back to his days at Hyde Park and his responsibility now to command a much larger estate. He thought about how he had been preparing for this day his entire life. Many more thoughts about the power and influence he could wield went through his head that day. And then, with one hand on the Bible and his right hand raised, FDR took the oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. Well, he could certainly defend his vision of the Constitution, which was redistribution of wealth, wildly expanded government, seizing power for the executive branch, and imprisoning U.S. citizens without cause, as he did with so many Japanese Americans.
Evacuation. More than 100,000 men, women, and children, all of Japanese ancestry, removed from their homes in the Pacific Coast states to wartime communities established in out-of-the-way places. Their evacuation did not imply individual disloyalty, but was ordered to reduce a military hazard at a time when danger of invasion was great. Two-thirds of the evacuees are American citizens by right of birth. The rest are their Japanese-born parents and grandparents. The people are not under suspicion. They are not prisoners. They are not internees. They are merely dislocated people, the unwounded casualties of war.
Roosevelt's philosophy was perhaps best articulated by the man who helped author his first inaugural address. This little-known Columbia University professor, who had helped form the inner intellectual sanctum of FDR's presidency, the Brain Trust, wrote of FDR,
"He believed that government not only could but should achieve the subordination of private interests to collective interests, substitute cooperation for the mad scramble of selfish individualism. He had a profound feeling for the underdog, a real sense of the critical unbalance of economic life, a very keen awareness that political democracy could not exist side by side with economic plutocracy."
The professor noted that, as with other inglorious liberals in America, Roosevelt drew directly on the likes of Woodrow Wilson, Herbert Crawley, and Walter Lippmann, among a who's who of other progressives. But perhaps learning from progressive titans before him, FDR knew he had a branding problem. The term progressivism was waning in the 1920s. The years between Wilson and FDR had witnessed America's return to its small government roots under Presidents Harding and Coolidge. In foreign affairs, the horrors of World War I called into question the idealistic notion that mankind was becoming more humane and more perfect with each successive generation. Progressivism was also being identified rightly with German philosophy, which had become far less appealing once the Kaiser unleashed a calamitous war on the world. At home, the American economy was booming. So while Herbert Hoover had been technocratic, like George W. Bush preceding Barack Obama, he laid the groundwork for programs that Roosevelt would later expand in crisis. Progressivism still receded. All of this led to FDR's purposeful rebranding of progressive ideology. During the 1932 Democratic National Convention, he explained,
"Ours must be a party of liberal thought, of planned action, on enlightened international outlook, and on the greatest good to the greatest number of our citizens."
FDR's new liberalism clearly betrayed the classic liberal thought of John Locke and Adam Smith, not to mention men who signed the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. It was a noble lie, a label cynically reappropriated to obscure the total break from the older meaning and tradition that progressive ideology represented. This new interpretation of American politics and governance that elevated the state above the individual, which had begun under Teddy Roosevelt and Wilson, accelerated under FDR. Rights no longer came from the individual, much less God, but directly from the government. This was everything that classical liberals had come to reject about the divine right of monarchs and the tendency of the state to trample individual liberty. FDR redefined progressives, the office of the presidency, and the United States Constitution. More on that in the next episode.
Glenn Beck.
Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Let me warn you, and let me warn the nation, against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things. We believe in Social Security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
The mocking tone worked. Of course we believe in Social Security, work for the unemployed, and saving homes. Actually, no self-respecting constitutional Republican would ever believe the government should supply any of those things. But just as progressives of today, like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, their forefather and forebearer of progressivism, FDR, set up the straw man arguments, then set them on fire. And of course, the academia of today continued to worship at the altar of the gigantic government anti-constitutional beast FDR created.
I share the view of almost all historians that Franklin Delano Roosevelt is the greatest president of the 20th century. And beyond this, I think that the policies he adopted to deal with this terrible crisis of the Great Depression are the most imaginative, the most creative of any president in our history.
A fascinating belief for a supposed historian, because as creative as his bloated government programs were, they certainly, unequivocally, did not work. Over a decade after implementing his socialized agenda, the New Deal, the United States of America was still mired in the deepest and worst depression in its history. Those programs FDR was so proud of, programs like Social Security, which is, in effect, a legalized Ponzi scheme, has been on the path to insolvency since the day it was signed. Roosevelt spent and regulated like a drunken sailor in spite of criticizing President Hoover on those very same grounds during the 1932 presidential race. And perhaps worst of all, he paid for it all by vastly expanding and steeping the tax code. What was only 400 pages at the start of FDR's administration ballooned to more than 8,200 pages by the end of it. While designed to make individuals and businesses pay their, quote, fair share, end quote, it had the effect of stifling economic growth and completely reshaping the economic promise of America from one of individual achievement into one of redistributive equality. The New Deal was designed to relieve suffering and put America on a sustainable and equitable path. But designed is the key word there. The actual effect was something else entirely. FDR, in fact, turned what would otherwise have been a depression into the Great Depression through his attempts at social and financial engineering. From 1933 to 1940, the average annual unemployment rate averaged 18.6%. The economy went on a capital strike as private investment didn't return to 1929 levels until 1941. FDR's constant experimentation created uncertainty, and there's nothing that private companies and stock markets hate more than that. Business was paralyzed as a result. In 1937 and 1938, after brief gains from the depths of the Great Depression, the economy collapsed into a double-dip recession. From 1937 to 1938, industrial production declined by 33%. National income hemorrhaged 13%. Wages went down by 35%. All of this, unsurprisingly, added up to an unemployment rate that rose by roughly 5 percentage points. An estimated 4 million workers lost their job. C.S. Lewis in God in the Dock could have been speaking for millions of demoralized Americans when he wrote,
"Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. Those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. They may be more likely to go to heaven, yet at the same time likelier to make a hell of earth."
Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr. may have summed it up best when he said that after 8 years of this administration, we have just as much unemployment as when we started, and an enormous debt to boot. So how did Franklin Delano Roosevelt continue to be elected time after time?
But fortunately for Roosevelt, the 1940 election had not served as a referendum on the imaginative policies of the past. The nation was still reeling from the effects of the Great Depression. Unemployment, which 8 years earlier had stood at 25%, still hovered close to 20%. FDR's victory was secured less for what he had achieved, and more as a result of his promise to keep American boys out of the fight against Adolf Hitler.
Which eventually turned out to be yet another promise unkept by FDR. Everyone seemed to be a loser, except for Roosevelt himself. After all, if his primary mission was to consolidate and retain power, his agenda would have been deemed a rousing success. But a simple rousing success was not what he had in mind. He wanted to be thought of as an all-time great. And a world war would be exactly the thing to get him there. In peacetime, spending and regulation were FDR's tonics for fixing what ailed America. But war provided him with an excuse to plan centrally on a far greater scale. And the free world depended on it. If America didn't reform, it would be occupied by Hitler's stormtroopers. Hitler himself was known to fantasize about, quote, the downfall of New York in towers of flames, end quote. In March 1942, before the United States had ever even entered the war, FDR warned journalists, "Nazi forces are not seeking mere modifications in colonial maps or in minor European boundaries. They openly seek the destruction of all elective systems of government on every continent, including our own." Fear of Nazi occupation, of losing everything we loved. But of course, there was hope. We could avoid war if we only could get our own economic house in order, which, in FDR's telling, meant giving more power to the federal government to regulate business and confiscate private property. Given this context, it shouldn't be too surprising that FDR conferred upon himself unprecedented executive powers after Pearl Harbor, including the right to ignore tariffs, close radio stations, order the military to take over any plot of land, close financial exchanges, and alter labor regulations. The federal bureaucracy boomed. The War Production Board, WPB, was created to direct production and allocate materials and fuel. It converted civilian industries into wartime industries, rationed basic materials, and regulated everything, down to even the quantity of fabrics used in dresses. Vice President Henry Wallace, the former agricultural secretary who supervised the hog slaughtering AAA, now headed the Board of Economic Welfare, BEW, which procured raw materials. Although the BEW spent $1.2 billion during the war, it was never authorized by law, nor did the Senate ever affirm Wallace's appointment to lead it. Under the BEW, Wallace sought to kill two birds with one stone by internationalizing the New Deal in service of the war. For example, he built rubber plantations in Haiti and Brazil while subsidizing the natives' general welfare. This sounds great until you look at the math. Private industry produced rubber for 30 cents a pound. The rubber from Haiti cost $546 per pound. Wallace, the architect of this debacle and the vice president of the United States of America, was thought by many to be at least a socialist, if not a full-fledged communist. Under these circumstances, how did America navigate its way through the Second World War and finally pull itself out of the Great Depression? More on that in the next episode.
Glenn Beck.